Hello. Thank you. Hi, I'm Jim Adams. I'm with Microsoft IT, and this is...
I'm Nate Bruno. I'm a service engineer and architect for Microsoft IT SharePoint.
And I'm a program manager in the space. I've been at Microsoft since 2000, and most of the time have been involved in SharePoint. How many people were having a great time? Good. For those of you who did not raise your hands, why are you here? Okay. Listening to me. Thank you. All right. So quickly, here's the agenda. We're going to talk about the what, where, and who, and then the how. And then we'll talk a little bit about futures, where we're going in MSIT. And then we'll have some Q&A at the end. Of course, if you have any really nagging questions and you have to ask it, go ahead and raise your hand and we'll try to accommodate. We have a lot of content, including four demos for you, so we'll try to keep it brisk. So let's get the show on the road here. So Microsoft has a global deployment, and it covers the Americas, North and South, Europe, Middle East, and Africa, and Asia Pacific. And we have three data centers that service our global population of SharePoint users, data center in Seattle, data center in Dublin, and one in Singapore. And the distribution of content between these three data centers is roughly like this, where we have 64% in the Americas, 21% in EMEA, and 15% in Asia. And there's some numbers there for the amount of terabytes of content that we have in each of these farms. Just a rough show of hands, how many people have enterprises that are larger than about 36 terabytes? I see one hand over here. Okay.
Yeah, a couple of shy hands.
A couple of shy hands. They're 35 and a half, and they don't want to admit it. Okay. So what's remarkable is the number of site collections that we have, almost 200,000. And you probably ask, why in the world do we have 200,000 site collections? Well, part of our job is to break the software. And we have open enrollment at Microsoft, so anybody with a card key badge, network access, can have one or more or as many SharePoint sites as they want or need or don't need. So we'll talk a little bit about governance later.
So are we actually at 36 terabytes?
No.
Oh.
We're actually at 38 terabytes. This was as of February 2012, so it keeps growing. The numbers always change from presentation to presentation.
I'm just keeping you honest.
Yeah. So what does it take to run this organization? It's amazing how many people are starting to trickle in. All these people want to know about us. No, probably not us, probably this stuff.
Probably the slides.
Anyway, we have what we call the SharePoint utility, and this is about 95% of everything that we have on SharePoint. And it's out-of-box SharePoint, zero customizations. 5% is devoted to our custom portal space, and this supports our organizations such as HR, legal and corporate affairs, what we call MSW, which is Microsoft Web, which is the landing page for everybody when they receive their laptop at Microsoft. It's preloaded with software, and the home page is set to MSW. And it's the main landing page for the entire company. And that's where you can bounce off and go to everything else within Microsoft. That's where you can search for any terms and get a plethora of content from our fast search farm. So we have roughly 15 full-time employees on the utility side. And we have about the same number on the custom portal side, but a big disparity in the number of vendors. Since the custom portal side requires a small farm for each custom portal space, we have a lot of vendors that do the day-to-day upkeep and maintenance of those server farms.
So what's the difference again between the blue and the purple folks?
The blue is just our employees, and then the purple are the number of vendors that we have. And this is going to change drastically as we move toward the cloud, because we're in the cloud, we're not going to have servers to take care of. So we'll talk a little bit about that toward the end of the presentation. So in our SharePoint utility space, we have our SharePoint farm, a permanent dog food farm called Team. And how many of you are not familiar with the term dog food? Got a few people here, so I have to explain what that is. So Microsoft is kind of unique in the industry that Microsoft not only deploys these solutions, applications, but they develop them and manufacture them. And we are, we are partners with the product groups to try out and deploy these software systems before they're even at beta. So we install pre-beta bits, and we inflict this pain on everybody at Microsoft. And the point is that we want to find bugs and problems with the software before it gets to manufacturing and to our customers. So in a nutshell, we eat our own dog food. And at any given time, we are dog fooding two or three different products at once. So if you come to Microsoft expecting a stable environment, you aren't going to get one because of the dog fooding. Okay? So we have our permanent dog food farm. We have our My Sites, our personal sites. We have an extranet. And we have our SharePoint Online presence. We're slowly moving everything to SharePoint Online from SharePoint on-premises. It's going to take us a while to get there. But we have to also dog food the online stuff. And what better way than to take everything that we have, or almost everything we have, and move it into the cloud?
We also have a shared services farm. I don't think it's up there, but it hosts our user profile application, managed metadata, web analytics, business connectivity services. So all of our shared properties are on this one farm.
Now, in our utility space and in our portal space, our custom portal space, we don't necessarily turn on all the features at once. This is a matrix of, this is also an eye chart. This is a matrix of the features that we turn on and features that we keep turned off in each of the farms that we have. And on the left-hand side in the white, in the light blue, we've got the utility stuff. And the dark blue is our custom portal offering. And you can see that there are two items that don't have anything turned on. One of them is email-enabled lists, and the other is VSTF. VSTF we haven't turned on because we anticipate going to the cloud where that's a native offering in the cloud space. But email-enabled lists are, well, in Microsoft, we do over 400 million emails a month for our on-premises Exchange farm, which equates to about 14.1 million emails a day and about 3 to 4 million before you even eat breakfast.
And so is that why my mailbox is always full when I get to work?
Yes. So at Microsoft, we have an adage, if it's worth doing, it's worth overdoing. And we feel that if we turned on email-enabled lists, SharePoint would just bloat because it becomes a secondary repository of email and email boxes. So we made a policy decision not to turn that feature on. In a small organization, it may not be an issue, but a large enterprise where you have pack rats, and I'm sure you have pack rats that want to save everything, it exposes you legally, and it just is bad practice. So that's why we don't turn on some features in some of the farms. So I'll turn it over to Nate for the architecture talk.
Cool, thanks, Jim. So I'm going to go over service architecture, how we did upgrade from SharePoint 2007 to 2010, some key guidelines around how we architected our farms for high availability and for performance, go over monitoring, kind of best practices we use in Microsoft IT, go over patching, how do we deploy software patches such as new CUs, cumulative updates, or made the latest and greatest service pack, And then I'll go over remote blob storage and how we deal with large video files.
So what architecture is signified by the Leaning Tower?
I would say RBS, but we'll get to that in a second.
Okay.
So at Microsoft IT and in the SharePoint world, we script everything. And this really helps us for both consistency and repeatability. Our install process is all scripted, and it really goes through three stages. The first stage is a pre-stage, which loads all the prerequisites to SharePoint. This might configure IIS, .NET framework, that sort of thing. The next stage is main, where it actually does the SharePoint install, maybe installs the language packs, cumulative updates, and then runs psconfig, connects it to the farm. The final stage, post, is a stage that deploys some of the farm-wide configurations, such as setting up your web app, maybe it's outgoing email settings, or maybe it's those advanced services that you have deployed on your farm. I've written some sample code and posted it to spauto.codeplex.com. There's a link in the far left corner. So check it out if you want just a quick sample. It's not completely what we do internally, just because it's kind of Microsoft-specific code. But it's definitely a way to get you help started.
So we use the database attach method. There was three methods before, database attach, gradual, and then there was an in place. Mm-hmm. Why did we settle on the DB attach?
So we really wanted to have a farm that was available for users when we did upgrade. The in-place method, the problem with it is you're upgrading the farm that you have, and you have to take downtime on it. The other disadvantage is we're going to 64-bit hardware, and we're running 32-bit on some of our servers before, and SharePoint 2010 only supports 64-bit hardware. So that's why we kind of went with the database attach method, because we're going to new hardware anyways. So let me go over how we did our upgrade. And this is very basic. I think there's a whole talk on upgrade here at TechEd, so go check that out if you have more questions, or we can talk questions afterwards. But what we did was we backed up our SharePoint 2007 content databases, marked them as read-only so users could still access them, did a copy and restore job to our SharePoint 2010 SQL instance, set those databases back to read-write so the upgraders could run, and then attach the content database to the farms. And this is where the upgraders kicked in. And we ran these in parallel, too, on different spindles on the SQL servers for best performance. And then afterwards, we validated the content, ran a couple of test scripts to make sure everything was working okay, and a lot of the new features were turned on correctly, such as Office web apps, that sort of thing.
Didn't we have a bunch of threads running parallel as well?
Yeah, we got up to 27 threads, so it's pretty amazing what SharePoint can do.
And what did we end up at? Because we brought the servers, the SQL servers, to the knees
with
27 threads, but what we backed it off?
Around 16.
About 16 threads. So if you have a lot of content and a fixed window to do your upgrade, you might consider doing multiple threads. Borrow SQL servers to do multiple threads.
And then afterwards, we flip over DNS, so users hit the new farm. So this is what we did as well. In addition to our database attach method, we use the AAM redirect, which really replaced granular update. And
that's alternate access mapping redirect, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, sometimes we use a lot of acronyms. I have trouble figuring out if the audience knows them or not, so Jim keeps me honest on that one. So on this scenario, there's an animation coming soon. It's on the left-hand side is your old farm, and on the right-hand side is your new farm. And what happens when you set up alternate access mapping redirect is a request comes in from the user trying to access their content on the new web app you set up, but it's not in the config database, so it gives you a 302 redirect to your old farm. And so where your old farm still has the content, it grabs the content and delivers that successfully to the user. So once you do your upgrade, what we were talking about in the last slide, you move your content over to the new farm. It does a little upgrade. It takes, some time. And then the user now does a query to the server, and the config database sees that it's there and then delivers the content to the user.
So before you do all this, you rename your existing farm to something else, and then you name your new farm to what the old farm used to be called. Mm-hmm. That way, when users try to access their old stuff, this alternate access mapping knows, yes, this database has been upgraded, go to the new farm. Or, no, this database is still on the old farm and routes you to the old farm. So this is kind of cool.
And it works out really well if you still have content that's not ready to upgrade to 2010. The caveat with it is some client applications such as Word, Excel, they don't understand the 302 redirect very well, so they don't redirect content. But most of the SharePoint stuff, all the IIS applications do. So now I want to go over how we architected one of our biggest farms, our North America SharePoint farm. And it's really a utility farm for all the company, like Jim was saying, where users can create their own sites at any time, and they might have multiple sites that they use or don't use.
And these would be all out-of-box SharePoint. No secret sauce.
So I'll go over the topology, how we design performance, and then also just how many requests we're getting in performance. And then I'll go into our storage design, how we optimize our storage. So here's our topology, what we ended up when we went to SharePoint 2010. So it's a quite large farm, but I'll go over how many requests we get in a second so you can see why it's so large. The machine on the far left is orange, and that's our crawl target. And the reason we have a crawl target is our crawlers in fast search consume a lot of CPU cycles, memory, and we don't want to have that have our customers experience that pain of they'll run into a latency on those crawl targets.
So users will hit all of the other front-end servers and never hit the crawl target, mm-hmm. and the fast search farm always hits the crawl target and never the other.
Yeah, so fast is happy, the users are happy, everyone wins. So we have 8 front ends, so users talk to these ones directly through our big IP load balancer, and then we have 4 application servers running Office web apps, Visio services, Excel access services, really all those services that Jim showed you earlier on that big eye chart. And then our SQL servers, we have 10 content database, or 10 content SQL servers, and they're running in an active-active mode, and we're using DAS storage for those. And then we have 2 a system configuration server, which has our service application databases on there, config database. And then we have a server just for usage database, because it's really high I/O intensive. So this gives you an idea of what our performance requests look like on a given day. The average request per second is around 800 requests per second. And a peak time, it's around 1,200. Our average unique users are around 100,000, and average concurrent users are around 5,000. And on the far right is just, I took this from a tool called SPDiag, which we'll go over in a second. But this shows you how many requests we're getting on a given day. You can see how it kind of curves up during that peak time. And what's really interesting about this is before we deployed SharePoint 2010, average concurrent users were around 1,000. So you could really see a huge increase of demand for SharePoint since we deployed the 2010.
Also, there were only 600 requests per second and only 300 average requests per second versus the 800. And peak, we had 600, and now it's doubled. Mm-hmm. So in less than a year, the same number of users generated a whole lot more requests for the service. It's taking off.
Yeah. So in our storage and I/O, we really focus on high availability and high reliability and performance. So we used RAID 10 for our config and content databases, and we set a max for our content database around 350 gigs. Online, they changed it since they released SP1 to a 4 terabyte limit. But the problem we've seen is it adds a tax to when you're doing backup restores, maintenance operations. So we try to keep it a little bit lower. We find that 350 to 400 gigs is a good size recommendation, at least for our need. But yeah, the product group says you can go up to four terabytes if needed. We also use RAID 10 for OS logs, usage database, all the really high I/O intensive. We use RAID 5 for read, low write, low. This is our pre-production environments, our test environments, our production environments that are maybe being phased out. When we were doing our storage design, we really found out when we worked with the storage team in MSIT that spindle count affects our performance. And we found that just on a given SAS drive, you're getting around 100 to 150 IOPS per spindle. And Jim will show you some recommendations that we found out on the next slide about spindle count and how it affects performance. So an interesting story with the SAN. About a year ago, we ran into some issues with our disk latency. And so a lot of users were complaining about that their SharePoint site was taking a really long time to load. And we found the bottleneck, and it was disk. And we went to the SAN team. We have a shared SAN team, and did a huge investigation and found out that we were using a shared SAN, and our neighbors were hogging the fiber channel, so which really hurt our performance on the SharePoint farm.
Our neighbors ended up being finance, and
yeah.
Every quarter they do strange things over in finance.
Yeah, I don't know why, budgeting or I don't know. So we saw some unpredicted load, which gave us two options. We could either go to our own dedicated SAN or switch over to DAS storage as long as we were able to achieve the performance we were looking for. So we did a mix of both. We went to the DAS storage for what we could for our large amount of content. And then we still use our shared SAN for not as heavy I/O intensive resources. So a good idea when you're focusing on storage design is focus on your I/O requirement, and also watch for cache flooding on your SAN. We've seen during backup events, there's burst events that you'll see a performance degradation. So
yeah,
plan for that.
So at previous talks, after we gave this slide, they said, okay, what would you recommend? Well, your mileage will vary, but if you can work with your storage people and get 1,000 guaranteed IOPS sustained per terabyte of content or 5,000 site collections, add to that another 50 to 100% for your burst events, you'll probably be okay. And that's based on empirical results from a SAN and storage survey that we did with our storage folks on our production farm. So that's a rule of thumb, not guaranteed to work, but it'll probably get you in the ballpark.
Okay, great.
Okay, so, speaking of IOPS, you've got a demo over here, right, of monitoring?
Yeah, that's correct. So this is our first tool that I wanted to demo. It's a free tool from Microsoft. It's one of my favorite tools to monitor SharePoint. I use it all the time, and our ops team uses it. It's called SPDiag V3. You can download it in MSDN at the SharePoint 2010 Administrator's Toolkit. And what it does is it pulls from your usage database. And so it gathers all the HTTP requests, ULS logs, your performance counters, pretty much everything, and puts it in one central store and kind of acts as the front end.
How many service managers are in the crowd? Not a one? Okay, we got one, two. How many would like to be No. Anyway, this tool is the service manager's friend because it gives you insight into quite a bit of information that is of concern to service management or program management of a deployment.
So I pulled up our team farm, and Jim was talking about this earlier, but this is our dog food portal. So availability can drop to 99.5 since it's our dog food farm, and we have that service level agreement. But luckily today it's at 99.9, which is good. So it's showing you performance. This is in milliseconds, and then also your availability and when it's dropping. You can zoom in, which is kind of nice. And then it'll have a start time and an end time, and then you can do queries off that range. So let's say I want to know what HTTP requests fired during 243 to 518. So this takes a second to contact SQL, but so here's all the HTTP requests. And then you can even do more filters, kind of like a SQL type filter. It has a lot of different options. So maybe I want HTTP status, not like 200.
And this is a freebie. You can download it off of where?
So it's on MSDN.
MSDN.
So.
And where does the data come from, Nate?
So this shouldn't find anything. It comes from the usage database.
Okay, usage database.
We've got some 404s. So there's one 404 that can be accessed during that time. But for example, you can look at performance counters. You don't have to look at individual servers, which I like. And so it's just a lot of information. Another nice feature of this tool is you can get requests per URL or requests per user. So in Microsoft SharePoint, we have these things called heavy hitters, where users that tend to overconsume from our farm and take a lot of our bandwidth.
So you can take names and go pursue them.
Yeah, so this MSW account, that one looks pretty bad, but turns out this is our search index crawler, so we'll leave him alone. But an interesting story with this one. A few weeks back, maybe even a month back, we saw really bad performance on our SharePoint farm, and we wondered what was going on. I fired up this tool and found that there's this one URL that was getting hit really, really hard. And it was regarding the base image for Microsoft IT. It turns out that team put a widget on their desktop that contacted SharePoint every 2 to 3 seconds and downloaded a list. So now we're getting 180,000 users contacting this list every sub-second. And if you think back,
slow performance.
Yeah, we went from 5,000 concurrent connections to 180,000. It's pretty high, and our SharePoint farm wasn't able to demand that kind of performance. So.
All right. All right. So that runs off of historical data in the usage log. We had a need to monitor things in as close to real time as possible. And this was about a couple of years ago, right when the Windows Phone was coming out and Silverlight was getting legs. We had a harebrained idea to maybe put one of our engineers on a project to see if we could put together a tool to monitor our farms in near real time using Silverlight. And this is the result. It can be accessed via web browser or Windows Phone or whatever on our corporate network. And it gives us essentially the same thing as an EKG. A heart rhythm. And it gives us a span of a few hours, and it gives us the latency of time to last byte for a given set of properties. And we call them smoke test sites. And we fire off a synthetic transaction that looks for specific strings on the smoke test sites. If you've ever used a ping tool, you know that SharePoint will return an error web page if it can't connect to your database. Well, that is a successful page render, according to you know, certain tools. So that was not suitable for us to figure out if the user experience was good or not. So we actually search for given strings on the web page itself, and we time how long it takes, and we plot them. And we plot them with various percentiles. So we can say that the web front end array can respond within a certain number of milliseconds. 90% of the users get this kind of a performance experience. 75% get this, etc. And this is great because we have this mounted on four monitors on the way to the break room. So our operations staff sees it going to the break room and coming back from the break room.
Yeah, not to mention our manager's office is right next door.
That's the downside. So. But if we have any service interruption, there'll be these red bars that are really hard to ignore. Unfortunately, the manager also finds it hard to ignore, and they come to us asking us, why is there a red bar on SharePoint or whatever? Anyway, we developed this tool. Unfortunately, it's really specific to Microsoft IT's implementation. So after our talks where we showed this thing off, people asked, can we get a copy of it? And we said, no. But I think Nate is going to show us how you can do a similar thing with out-of-box SharePoint.
Yeah, so that's right. Basically, users came to us and go, oh, this is great, you know, but how does this apply to us? We want it, you know, but we just can't deliver it because it's so Microsoft heavy in the code. So I developed something similar using Power Pivot, just out-of-the-box tools, so I could help share with users that were trying to deliver the same kind of results. We're still working on getting the back end as far as the synthetic transaction tests, time to last byte, and then the database schema delivered out to customers. But if you can't wait, send me an email and maybe we can work something out. So here's a dashboard I created in Power Pivot. And what's nice about this tool is I'm looking at maybe 500,000 records in SQL, and I can do queries this really quickly. And so this is my SharePoint farm. Let's zoom here. So on the left-hand side, I create a slicer for all of my different environments. And then underneath is the servers, individual servers for those farms. And then on the right-hand side, you see the overall service latency. And then the bottom graph is the actual errors occurring in our farm during that time. And what's nice is I also created a table that lets me know the exact test that failed, what the status code and status code descriptions are, so I can go to those servers and figure out what was wrong during those times. Or maybe even use my friend SPDiag to figure out if there's any performance issues or event, go to the event log, that sort of thing. So I also, from this data, an alternative view is through the Power View tool. And this was delivered in SQL 2012. And it's what I liked about it was the Power Pivot probably took me a couple hours to create, and I've been tweaking around with it over time. So it's kind of a bigger project for me. But Power View, it took me maybe 10 minutes to set up. And it uses the Power Pivot model. So all you have to do is connect your Power Pivot, and then you're able to create a custom dashboard. It's using Silverlight, and it's fairly quick as well. So let me just click on a service property. And everything refreshes. Then I can zoom in to maybe one of my latency spikes. And then I can also look at errors that happened during that time. So I found it pretty cool. It was my first time really playing around with the Power View tool. And you can also hook this up to your PowerPoint slide deck, which is nice because if you're delivering a presentation, you can add some interactivity to it.
And that's live data in your PowerPoint?
So Yeah, that brings up a good point. I have the Power Pivot set up to refresh once a day in SharePoint, and it looks like this. But if you want to refresh more than once a day, you have to hook up your data set directly to SQL Analysis Services, and you can actually have it refresh every 5 minutes or 15 minutes or 1 minute, and that's kind of my next stage for this attempt to get it as similar as I can to that EKG tool. So.
All right. Okay, just went over that.
Okay. So now I want to talk about how we do our software patching at Microsoft, and this is our cumulative updates and our SP1s, that sort of thing. What we do is we follow an easy format that anyone can kind of reproduce. It's basically we take half of our servers out of rotation in our big IP tool, run the software updates on the tool, reboot those servers, and then we back up. We do the same thing on the other 50%. And then we back up the content databases, and then we do the upgrades per spindle, like I talked about earlier. So at this time, the farm's still alive, it's still ready, but it's in compatibility mode. So we need to run psconfig.
What's compatibility mode?
So compatibility mode is a mode that SharePoint lets you use the farm, but it doesn't enable the latest and greatest features. So we set up a downtime page, and this is usually around 30 minutes of downtime for our larger farms, and then run psconfig on each server. Once we validate everything's okay, we remove the downtime page, and then we complete our software patching cycle. So I want to talk about remote blob storage. We don't use it in our group, and the reason for this is when we were procuring hardware, it wasn't supported. And we really wanted to invest more into remote blob storage, but now our main focus is shifted to focusing on cloud. And Jim will go over this during the end of the presentation. An alternative that we've been looking into as well is tiered storage, basically having your SSD drives deliver your highest used content, both dynamically and manually. So either we place it in SSD or May the Sand places it dynamically. And then having your lower use storage in RAID 10 or RAID 5. We get the question a lot of what we do with large video files at Microsoft. And we actually have a custom solution developed that we use SharePoint as a front end, but the back end's a file server that connects to CDN, a content distributed network, and delivers the content quickly to the region the user's in, and that can both be streaming or video on demand. So I wanted to go over how we do service operations at Microsoft. It's a fairly simple ITIL model, and it goes through incident management, our ticketing, our customer escalations, our config management, how we change over time, how we deal with that. Asset management, how we keep records of all our inventory. And then change management, how we use process to deliver change.
Who's familiar with the term entropy as it relates to configurations? Yeah, hot topic. I put together a short questionnaire. You don't have to answer directly, but this is true or false, okay? Play along with me, okay. True or false, our servers maintain their originally configured settings indefinitely. True or false, server settings are never changed during troubleshooting and incident management. And if they are, they're always reverted back to their original settings. Okay, last one. True or false? We have no cowboys in operations. Okay. Well, okay. This is a great segue into configuration management.
Cool. Thanks, Jim. So how we deliver configuration management, we use a tool called Power Rules, which is developed by our team and another shared team at Microsoft. I'm also working on sharing this out to public, just working with the legal team to scrape any Microsoft specific information.
And by Power Rules, that's just what we call the collection of PowerShell scripts for MSIT. Mm-hmm. So it's nothing really proprietary. It's just a bunch of scripts that we just call Power Rules.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a bunch of PowerShell rules that you define an environment and run a set of rules against them, and they can either pass or fail. We also have a Stay Current initiative, which we try to be on the latest and greatest OS and SQL. So we're always running the N or N plus one. In our example, it's SQL 2008 R2 and SQL 2012. And same with Windows. We're trying to get on Windows 8 once it gets released. We have some dog food out there as well.
And we have a demo of Power Rules. So,
yeah.
You ready?
So let me get it set up. So I have a SP2010 farm I set up, and all I do is I run the PowerShell command. It does a audit, runs a bunch of WMI calls, and I don't know if you can see this here, but let me zoom in. 1 second. Too much things open. There's my ZoomIt tool. So I have two servers here being audited. One's a web front end, one's an app server. And we got one failure, but 18 passes. So this might be a report that I run daily, especially after any major maintenance, to make sure configurations don't change. We also have a tiered support, which I'll get into later, and sometimes they make changes and don't revert things.
So the configurations are held in XML files that have the golden configuration for a given server type. So Windows front ends will have a golden configuration XML file. SQL Server might have an XML file to represent it. So each role has a golden file. You run this tool, it reads the type of server within a configuration XML file, and it says, oh, you've got all of these Windows front-end servers. Windows front-end servers have this golden configuration. Pulls up that XML, runs the audit against the server list, compares what it gets back from its audit to the golden standard. If it doesn't match, you get a red line. You get an error, and it tells you what the error was. So you can audit on a regular basis your server configurations against the golden standards. And as your environment evolves, you evolve the golden standards for the standard of the month or standard of the particular configuration. And this is all done in a read-only basis. It does not write or correct the server configurations. It only flags the errors.
Yep. So, oh man, I just set up this demo, and it looks like there's already a failure on my side. How'd that work? So let's take a look at this one. Disable loopback check. So I'm going to go, I actually know what the setting is. It's in the registry. And there's a disable loopback check option. And I want to mark it as true, which in hexadecimal, that's this one. So I changed it. And now I'm going to rerun my power rules to see if that error went away. So I'm going to rerun power rules on the farm. So it looks like it fixed it. No failures. So let's just scroll down a bit. And we can also see.
So if you have a compliance officer in your organization for configuration management, this will create a form that lets you sign off on given configuration items in the sign-off column. It just helps you audit your systems very quickly and painlessly.
Mm-hmm. A Okay, great.
And this we provide to our audience?
Yeah, so I'm working on delivering the MSDN code release, but if you contact me either on my blog or email afterwards, I can get you a copy of the code if that's something that you're interested in learning more about or using it for your group. Another thing I want to mention about config management is we run the latest security patches each month. Sometimes these come with a 24-hour turnaround, which we can't do much about, but most of the time, it's patches are released on the second Tuesday of each month. We deploy those to our pre-production, our tests on Wednesday, Thursday, and then hit production on Friday. So we kind of have this rhythm of business, which works out really nice.
Keep going. There you go.
So I want to talk about change management. Some customers ask, how do we control change in our environment? And this is part of that. We create a kind of a rhythm of change where it's a two-week system. If a request comes in before Monday, it goes to the authorized stage, the Tuesday through Thursday. And this is where we validate, hey, is it all automated? Is there a rollback plan? So a lot of these things that we look for before approving it. And then we assign it to an engineer on Friday to make sure someone is available during that time to deploy next week. And then week two, the engineer tests in our pre-production, make sure it works out, it validates correctly in the environment. And then on Friday, from 6 to 10 local server time, they deploy it.
So it's a two-week process. But what happens if we have a break fix, Nate?
So break fix is a little bit different. We try to have as minimal of these as possible, but they still come up, and we usually deploy those off hours during the night and then file a change ticket.
Right, but there is an emergency cab that we can pull to assemble the proper amount of oversight for any fix, and that can be, you know, at 2 in the morning if we had to. So we do have urgency within our capabilities.
Something also to mention, we have change freeze windows, and this is usually during end of year in financial budgeting times and that sort of thing where we can't make any changes to the farms. And this really promotes stability and helps our users out so we don't make a change that might affect their experience, even though it shouldn't be down, but, you know, who knows. So
here's another question for you. do your servers breed...
The questions just get weirder and weirder, huh?
Yeah, they do. Anyway, just having an inventory is a really neat thing to have. And Nate has an asset management tool that he created with SPPivot that I think he's going to demonstrate here.
Yep, so let me get it all ready.
Okay.
Okay, cool. So this is different from PowerPivot. It's actually developed in the Live Labs team at Microsoft, but it's free code and you can download it online, which is nice. So what I want to do is I'll bring up a display of all of our servers that we manage. So here they all are. You can kind of zoom using the deep zoom technology. It's fairly neat.
That's it. Isn't that neat?
Yeah. That's it. Thanks for coming. No. So I'll show two scenarios where this might be useful for you. So let's say we're doing a stay current project, like I was talking about earlier, and we're getting rid of our Windows Server 2008 Enterprise. We're actually upgrading those machines. So what I want to do is I want to sort by OS version and then graph this. So it puts it in different buckets. So I can see, oh, well, this is pretty nice. Most of my servers have already been upgraded. But I still have this cluster, and I also have this cluster that probably needs to be reconfigured in the asset management tool.
No info?
Yeah. They
you
don't have
be kidding.
OS or, you know.
Wow.
So let's just take a look at our servers that we want to add to the state current project. Well, it turns out, let's sort by service application, because it turns out there's different engineers for each property. That support those specific SharePoint farms. So, okay, it's spread a lot, which which is good and bad. So, but I got another news. I got an email saying, okay, only EMEA is what we're concerned about. So only EMEA servers. So let me take a look at the building and look which ones are in EMEA. It looks like only Dublin is in EMEA. So let's take a peek at that. So now I can really drill down. This is a lot more manageable. Okay, there's three web front ends and four SQL machines. And now I can contact the engineer that supports these three farms to make sure they're compliant by end of week or whatever the requirement is. And there's also more information about each server, and you can add information quite easily. Another scenario, so let's clear all that. So go back to the original view. So another scenario might be server warranties. We're coming up a period where some of our servers are running end of life. So what I want to do is I'll sort by let's sort by building name. So let's see here what servers are in which building. Turns out most of them are in Washington, but we have servers all over the world. So and then let me look at the facet that is warranty date. And let me look for the next 2 months. So let's go July, August. Okay, great. So we can see that these are the servers that we need to do something about in Charlotte, Dublin, Singapore, and Tukwila. And you can see how it's a lot more manageable than looking at all the servers at once. So.
And where do they get this?
Oh, so I actually have a link for it. I didn't put it on the deck, but it's at sppivot at codeplex.com. And if you have any questions, let me know. I find it pretty easy to make. All you have to do is get the data you're looking for and put it in an Excel document. And it looks something like this. And then it has an Excel plugin that says publish collection. So it took me maybe an hour or two to set up for the data that I pulled from our internal tool. So it's a good way to, you know, if nothing else, maybe impress your manager by the flashy animation. So
works for me. All right.
So I wanted to go over incident management, how we do that in MSIT SharePoint. I think we do it pretty standard, but tier one, we have a help desk team that's 24/7. They're not SharePoint experts, but they can read troubleshooting guides.
And it's a general help desk that follows the sun.
Yeah, so they support pretty much everything, but they can read a troubleshooting guide and figure out if they can solve the issue or it needs to go to a more knowledgeable team. So then there's tier two, which is an international team that's 24/7. And these are SharePoint experts, but they're very generalist. They don't know very siloed areas. And then MSIT SharePoint operations tier three, these are the silo owners of the farms. This is something like someone that owns Fast Search, Shared Services, maybe it's our North America farms. And then if they don't know the problem, we escalate it to customer service and support, CSS, similar to what our customers would do. So we can share that experience instead of randomizing the product group. During the dog food cycle, we're allowed to randomize the product group, so that's pretty fun. I'll sit in their office and tell them, you know, they're wrong and that sort of thing. But, we go through the standard route that our customers go through. So another topic that customers ask us a lot about is governance and site lifecycle. So Jim's going to talk about this real quick.
All right. So I briefly mentioned that anybody that had network access at Microsoft, whether they be a full-time employee or a vendor, can stand up their as many SharePoint sites as they want. Well, we put together a tool that we put on our provisioning portal called AutoSites. And if you're familiar with the self-service site creation tool, this looks remarkably similar to it. It's just that we've added a second page that asks them to give a drop of their blood and agree to some terms and conditions. And they don't get their site until they say, yes, I will comply to our PII and our classification policies within Microsoft. So once they fill out the information regarding compliance, what are they using the site for, et cetera, whether the site will contain content that can be deemed HBI, MBI, LBI, and I'll go over that in just a minute, what type of content do they want to put on there, and metadata regarding what type of site it is, so that when we do a search, we would be able to classify the content from this particular site. Once they get their site provisioned, if they answer all the questions, they get a standard SharePoint site. Except you probably don't have that little logo up in the top, that red thing that says hi, or it's, if it's yellow, it'll say medium, or if it's low, it'll be green. This is the classification for the site that dictates what type of content can be put there without getting in trouble from our auditors. We audit these sites randomly. And if a low security site has high security content, such as, you know, performance review information, telephone numbers, social security numbers, credit card information, they will be shut down immediately, if not sooner. So these are the classifications: high, moderate, and low. And whenever anybody comes to Microsoft and they sign the terms of employment, they agree that they will protect the assets of Microsoft according to the policy that they had to read through, that was this thick that they say they did read through. Okay?
Yeah, this, click the checkbox at the end. Is that one of those policies?
Yeah. Okay. So that's what you get with a SharePoint site. Now, along with the classification with the metadata and all that, there was a feature that is lacking in SharePoint, and that is an expiration date for your site collection. Now, you might think, yeah, there is an expiration. It's this site delete feature. Don't use the site delete feature. It was written many years ago by probably an intern. It hasn't been touched since then. It's a black box. Don't use it. Use something similar to this. So, site collections will expire in 1 year, or depending on the farm, if it's one of the custom farms, it may have a six-month expiry. But come your 11th month of ownership of your site collection, you'll get a little alert at the bottom of your site. And it will tell you that there's an alert and that you need to re-up or delete your site collection, or have it deleted for you if you don't re-up. This is a great way of keeping the content down. Okay, SharePoint is not an archive. SharePoint is a repository for living, breathing documents, and if you want to archive, there are other solutions that don't get searched every single day, that don't get backed up every single day, and cost a whole lot less. So you get notified. If you proceed to ignore the notification, you'll get a nasty gram. Nasty gram comes in your email. You'll keep getting these until your site is pretty much deleted. Now, we don't delete your site collection. We husk it. We make it inaccessible, but we keep it for 30 days. We keep it for 30 days in the back burner. Can't access it unless you call the help desk and say, oh, I forgot to re-up. We have a site recycle bin in case it gets deleted after 30 days and you forgot to inform us that you forgot to notify us, and we keep that for a period of 90 days, something like that, site recycle bin. How many people know how many mouse clicks it takes to delete a site collection accidentally? One? No. Two? No, not three. Five clicks of the mouse to accidentally delete your site collection. It's a pet peeve of mine. Anyway, I digress. All right, so when you receive your nasty gram at Microsoft and you go to the link that it provides you, simply re-upping it, saying, yes, I agree to all this, and you hit OK, it will renew your site collection for another six months or a year. You can also reclassify it if the site collection is being used differently than when you first created it. So this is how we keep a handle on prolific site collections.
Yep, and it also saved us a lot of storage in the long run.
Right.
Like, we'd be growing probably over 40, 50 terabytes by now.
Yep.
So,
disaster recovery or enterprise business continuity management is also part of governance. And sometimes it's called disaster recovery, sometimes it's called business continuity management. It's not to be confused with high availability. High availability is mirroring, is making sure that the service is highly available from a single data center. In case there's a disk failure or whatever, you still have your services available. So disaster recovery is something entirely different, and it's the only service we hope never to use, right? If we use it, that means something really bad happened.
Hey, okay? Jim, I see something odd on the top right corner. What is that thing?
Does anybody recognize the Mayan calendar? So if you're working on a disaster project, all you have to do is delay until December 23rd. Then you don't have to worry about it anymore, okay? In fact, all of my recurring meetings at Microsoft, after the December 23rd, I put down as tentative. So disaster scenarios. What comes to mind when I mention unmitigated disaster? How about something like that? If that happens, SharePoint is the least of your problems.
I heard hurricanes from the audience. That would be a
hurricanes,
good one.
Yeah. Anybody recognize that puppy?
Oh.
Yeah, that's Katrina. Those are natural disasters. There's other types of disasters, man-made disasters. There's one, the Stanley Cup. Actual Vancouver, British Columbia picture. Riots, they affected several banking institutions in Vancouver. Here's another one. This is the Howard Hanson Dam. It's upriver from our main Seattle data center. And it developed some cracks in it about 2 years ago. That's also, coincidentally, the time that our board of directors said, do we have disaster recovery for our Seattle data center? If not, let's get disaster recovery in our Seattle data center. So this is an example of a man-made disaster. Anybody think of any others? Things that you just wouldn't think of. And also there's hardware failures and software failures that could possibly bring down a data center. Maybe a disk drive catches on fire and takes out an entire floor of your data center, including the fiber that comes in. You're not going to have a data center. So a couple years ago, our board of directors said, okay, you guys need to figure out what your vital assets are in SharePoint. Protect them. So they also didn't fund us. They said we had to do it with existing resources. So we said, okay, we can do this, but we're not going to boil the ocean. We're going to do it with the most important assets first. And we'll create a secondary data center. And we will protect just those critical assets. So we put out a call to all of the vice presidents in the company, GMs in the company, said, okay, what are your most vital assets? And how much are they worth to you for us to back up and put into the Columbia Data Center? We weren't going to charge them, but we weren't going to tell them that. That's one way to keep the amount of stuff that you have to back up to a minimum. If they think they have to pay for it, they'll think twice. So that's a good strategy for you. So our main data center is in Seattle. We call it the Rainier Data Center. And our secondary is in Quincy, Washington. And we call it the Columbia Data Center. Does anybody see anything wrong here? Distance. Yes, it's only 250 50 miles as the crow flies. But that's okay, because we have five volcanoes separating the two data centers. I wish that I was joking, but that's our primary and secondary data center. Now, we do not mirror everything in our primary data center in the secondary data center because we aren't protecting everything in our primary data center. We're protecting maybe 5% of all the content that we have, those things that were labeled as critical by the vice presidents that we asked. And we stand up just enough hardware in our Columbia data center to support the things that we do move over. And here's what we do. We take a log, we take a backup snapshot every 5 minutes, and we send it across to our secondary data center. We also have some control databases with some fake sites that we also replicate over there. That way, at any given time, if there is a spring audit that they inflict upon us, we can take those databases containing just those fake sites that are in the same farm, same hardware, and demonstrate that, yes, the stuff is being log shipped, it is being tracked, we do have disaster recovery for the remaining properties. So the failover process is all documented to where even a caveman could do it. It's all in a document where you can cut and paste. The cut and paste segments are even color-coded. So if there is a disaster, smoking hole, Seattle goes into the Pacific Ocean, someone from our Dublin data center, our Winnipeg data support center, Beijing, China, wherever, they can follow the disaster procedure and cut and paste into a scriptable window from our DRP. And
we
in
also,
essence,
test it multiple times a year.
Yes.
So just to make sure it's still reliant, still accurate.
Yep. So the failover process is we suspend the log shipping because the source data is no longer there. There's a smoking hole there. We detach the read-only database copies on the receiving side. We attach the log ship DBs, and we verify the failover was successful by testing the URLs at our secondary site, and we then make a DNS change to point to the secondary location.
Do we use DFSR?
We don't use DFSR, but if your data center is, say, 5,000 or more miles away, you might have latency and bandwidth issues, and you might take a look at DFSR to replicate in that type of a scenario, because it is more tolerant than native SQL log shipping. So once we do this, the site is online in the secondary. So futures. We've got, how much time do we have?
About 7 minutes.
7 minutes, okay. We'll quickly go through this, and then we'll open it up to some Q&A. But we'll also make ourselves available after, because this is the last session. We have the luxury of a little more time out in the hallway. We'll be happy to answer any questions that you might have. So for dog food, we're always looking to the next version of the software because we have to roll it out before everybody else. So we're working on the next version of SharePoint with our product group. We can't give you any details because we don't know any details yet, but that's what we will be doing in the next few months. And we'll begin work with the product group on features for even the next wave after that. So this is our dog fooding strategy. We work with the product group on the N plus one, N plus two products. Now, I mentioned earlier that we are doing a migration to the cloud. We're taking our terabytes and terabytes of content that we have on premises, and we're moving it into Office 365, SharePoint Online, public. We aren't even going into a private cloud. We're actually going into the public cloud with SharePoint Online. We're currently moving over our extranet content, our SharePoint large farm content, and our team over the next few months. Things that would affect the rate at which we do this is pure physics, because the SharePoint Online data centers are located in San Antonio and Chicago for us. In order to get 36 terabytes of content into those data centers using the little tiny cocktail straw that they gave us as far as bandwidth, it's going to take us several years. So we're engaging some third-party help to get us there quicker. This also has a side effect of providing disaster recovery for the rest of the stuff that we aren't doing with our own log shipping. So just by going to the cloud, SharePoint Online, we get redundancy and DR protection as a part of the service. And if we do all the math, the funny money that passes between Microsoft and Microsoft IT, it's about a wash. It costs us about the same to go to the cloud as it does to stand up our own stuff. The big difference is we don't have to worry about the servers and patching and all that stuff, because that's a part of that service. So we're transferring that risk to another group, and Microsoft IT can survive with fewer vendors, and the full-time employees that we do have can concentrate on the service itself and the add-ins and making the experience better. So that's what we're doing in the Office 365 space for SharePoint. Exchange-wise, we're going to the cloud as well. We have approximately 200,000 mailboxes within Microsoft. We've already migrated about 36,000 of those into the cloud, and we'll be migrating about 80% of everything that we have, Exchange mailbox-wise, into the cloud by the end of next fiscal year. So we're putting a lot of emphasis on migration to the cloud. It gives us durable benefits, such as the DR, and allows us to concentrate on things that we'd like to concentrate on, like service and
customer experience,
rather than patching servers and things like that. So with that,
yeah,
I haven't seen these slides either. I'm thinking they might have added those without us knowing about it. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, that's all right. And I'm sure you've seen these slides before. And last slide, please fill out the survey, because we live off of your feedback. Mm-hmm. And thank you very much. And we will make ourselves available outside or somewhere around here. Just find us. And thank you very much.
Thanks.